Yeah, guys, my name is Juan. I pastor type thing in Pretoria, and I'm interested in reconciliation. And I'm part of an organization called Beter Einders, and we do all sorts of quirky and not so quirky stuff to try and facilitate that. And I'm interested in Wolf because I am. I think from a theological perspective, trying to follow Jesus, but also be passionate about reconciliation is to try and get the language. Wolf is a very handy ally in that endeavor. And when I started reading it, I realized that I'm really not that smart, and I need help to talk about this thing so I can get smarter people to talk me through some very heavy theology. So this is more of a support group, a Wolf support group, trying to make sense of Wolf. So if you fit in that category, then you are most welcome. I do, however, I know that some of you are academics, and as the layman here, I want to warn you that I am going to mute you if you guys go too technical. So please help us make sense of this thing. This is not a bragging competition and trying to show the rest of us how inferior we are. I think this is not a university colloquium, a bunch of ordinary people trying to make sense of Wolf and reconciliation and Jesus, etc. So that's one thing I want to say to all you academics out there. Before we get started, we're going to do this for 6 weeks. And then on the 30th, Professor Wolf was kind enough to, he's going to join us for a Zoom, and we can ask him a couple of questions, which is very exciting. And then alongside a guy called Nat Schluter, some of you might know, he's over at JBC. We've had contact with Wolf for some time now. And we hope to bring him out early next year, virus permitting. So he's agreed to it, and he's going to come and do a couple of things here in South Africa, but it's a little bit up in the air because there's a virus up in the air. So that's the that's what's happening at the moment with Wolf. But we're at least going to get him for a Zoom, and hopefully we're going to get him in person soon. So I know we're quite a few people, and I know we want to talk about Wolf. But if I can ask you to just briefly unmute yourself, if you are comfortable, if you don't want to, you don't have to, but just tell us your name and just why are you interested in this book club? Because it's kind of a nerdy thing to do on a Wednesday night. So just briefly tell us who you are and why are you here? If I can, Toby, let me ask you, because I know you and I can pick on you, and then we can just unmute ourselves and share very briefly who we are and why we're here.
Thanks, Juan. I read the book a few years back, thoroughly enjoyed it, and found it to be insightful in speaking to, without trying to, speaking to, I think, a lot of the issues that we're dealing with in South Africa. So, I find it helpful because he's a guy that doesn't come from a typical either South African or American context. So interested from that point of view. I work both at a church and at a ministry called City to City Africa. And that's me.
Thanks, Toby. Please don't be polite, Christians. Just butt in.
I won't be polite. Oh, hi, this is Torsten and Vera. We're not showing our videos because we're eaten. We're here because Johan dragged us into it, but also because, that book was written something like 25 years ago. He speaks of today.
Hi, everyone. Itai here. I am I'm not in Wednesday evening. I'm in Wednesday afternoon. I'm in Toronto, and Johan and Torsten, and Torsten has just spoken, and one other, we're part of, and myself, we're part of a thing called Real Talk, We've been talking about these sorts of things for some time in South Africa. I've been in Toronto since March, and I'm also putting a baby to sleep, so you'll excuse the noise and chaos. Wolf is always interesting.
Thanks, Itai.
Hi, my name's Marilyn, and I'm a nerd, so that's basically, it's a nerdy thing to do, and I'm a nerd, so it kind of suits me to be here. I have heard good things about the book, haven't read it. I have much respect for Miroslav Volf, and so I'm interested, and I'm interested in the topic of inclusion, so yes.
Cool, thanks Marilyn. Brighton, I think you were about to say something.
Yeah. Hi, everyone. I'm Brighton, and obviously not a nerd, despite the glasses. So, I mean, besides Johan dragging me here, obviously not dragging me, but I think I'm very interested in the topic. I think I've become very skeptical about such topics because I always kind of know how the script kind of, you know, plays. But yeah, I'm very open-minded to this one. We'll see how this one goes.
It's a lot of pressure, Brighton.
Hi, Tinus here. I'm also joining you on in the afternoon. I'm in Bermuda, South African, but living in Bermuda. Yeah, I made the mistake of asking you on a few questions few weeks back, and yeah, now I'm here. He said I must join, so I haven't read everything or the whole book yet, but I started with it. But yes, let's see where we go. I'm very excited because it's an issue everywhere in the world, even on this small tiny island of Bermuda.
Thanks, Tinus.
Hi everyone, my name is Anandi. I started reading the book. I did like one chapter last year and then I stopped. So I'm super excited about a group to read it with and to discuss a topic I think that's near to everyone's heart.
Can you just unmute yourself?
Everyone, this is Corinne. I spend a lot of time on Zoom for work, which is why I have my sunny spot, favorite sunny spot in the garden as my virtual background. I'm here partly because I'm a nerd like Marilyn. I'm currently, for fun, proofreading master's theses, proposals, and things like that. I find books and discussions like these very valuable in helping me to sensibly articulate things that I feel I have a sense of. So that's why I'm here on a Wednesday night.
Karusta, I think you were about to say something.
I was. Thank you, Johan. Hi, everyone. I'm Karusta. I live in Cape Town. The one good thing that came out of lockdown is that we get the opportunity to have stuff like this. I am very proud to be a nerd, and I'm very excited about this reading group.
Thanks, Karusta. We're almost there, guys.
Hello, I'm Aaron. I am also a nerd, and I know it's an important book, so it would be interesting to see what comes out of the discussion.
From Herman from Belgium. Okay, cool. Kirsten, go for it.
Yeah. So I'm Kirsten. I'm in Joburg. I guess I love nerds, or I'm a wannabe nerd. I'm not an academic, let me just put it out there, but I work in the space. And so I was really pleased when Johan invited me to join this group. I haven't read the book, but I'm really keen to to learn a biblical perspective. Yeah, so really, really grateful. Thank you on all these things.
Cool.
Hi, everyone. My name is Mpo. I'm calling in from Bushbuck region in Mpumalanga. I'm here for work, but I'm based in Johannesburg. I was also invited by Johan. I'm interested. I haven't read the book, but the subject matter here, something that is close to my heart, and I'm always interested in getting to know what God thinks about these things. So I'm happy to be here, and I'm looking forward. Yeah, like I said, I haven't read the book, but I just I'm kind of going to be using everyone just hearing your thoughts on it to basically know more about the book, which I'll get to read at a later time. Thanks.
Thanks, Mpho. Thanks, guys. Yeah, look, please don't feel guilty if you haven't read it. And also, if you are just a thief, basically trying to, feed on other people's reading, then you are totally welcome here. So even if you're just interested in some of the ideas, but you don't necessarily want to wade through the whole book, like you are totally welcome. So the homework is really just for those guys who want to work through it chapter by chapter. So what is a little bit unfair is, I know this is our first round, but because we've asked Miroslav, and he's available on the 30th of September, Wednesday night, that's going to be the 7th Wednesday from now. I know I didn't communicate this well or at all, but I'm sort of assuming that you guys read till the end of Distance and Belonging, which is the second chapter. Again, if you didn't, it's super okay, because the themes do repeat themselves. But I want us to talk about that. And even again, if you just listen in and hear some of the thoughts from the other guys, then you are most welcome. So can I just ask, who of you did either the first two chapters or read the book recently and has something to share about what stood out for them? Otherwise, I can just go through some of my notes. I'm happy to do that. So let me just get it started with. So I've got the new edition, and he wrote a preface. The rest of the book is, I think, pretty much the same, except the thing on gender, the chapter on gender. But the rest of the book is pretty much the same. But he did write this new preface, The Resurgence of Identity. And the one thing that I find very interesting is he says that, when I was writing Exclusion and Embrace, the idea of a common humanity was generally accepted. In the text, I could simply assume it, not anymore. And the identitarians of the new right are not the only ones contesting it. Some on the left are doing so as well. Hence the absence of a shared horizon and competing moral universes. And this right at the time when the new climactic regime is sweeping across all our boundaries with a vengeance. What I could assume back then, I need to defend now. Which is very interesting, that the way the conversation in what he calls the new tribalism, the way it's shifted the conversation either to the far left and the far right, and in a South African context, that might be made evident by the fact that the only two political parties that grew in the previous election were the Freedom Front on the right and the EFF on the left. But on the radical spectrum of these identitarian poles, if you will, you can't necessarily appeal to a common humanity, something that he assumed. So that needs defending now, that there is commensurability, that we can actually have a conversation and that we can appeal to sort of a common universal value, which is an interesting observation, and which is why this book is more important probably than before. Now I'm moving on. I'm not sure if anybody wants to butt in at this stage, but What I could possibly do, just to set the stage, is just give you my notes, or some of the things that stood out in the first two chapters, and I hopefully won't be long, and then we can talk about some of the things that you might have read, or some of the things that you heard now. Also, I just want to stress this, that I realize that when a person can, two people can read the same page, and they will come to radically different conclusions, or they will see different things. So just because this is what I underlined and what stood out doesn't mean that this is the only thing that the first two chapters said. So I just wanted to put that out there. But what I do find interesting in this first chapter, the cross, the self, and the other, is that he talks, there's a subheading called social arrangements and social agents. And he goes on talking about various options that we have in structuring society. And he talks about the universalist options. In other words, there are certain universal values that we talk about. He talks about the communitarian option, which I think is more of sort of an apartheid light, where different nation states, etc. form. He talks about the postmodern option. And I, whilst I was reading that, I was trying to figure out which one I prefer. And then on the next page, he says that in contrast to all of these various options that I just listed, I will concentrate here on social agents. Instead of reflecting on the kind of society we ought to create in order to accommodate individual or communal heterogeneity, I will explore what kind of selves we need to be in order to live in harmony with others, which in our current conversation is very interesting, because it is taking it away from just power structures and seeing the world, I think at least, please disagree with me, seeing the world just in terms of a macro power structure. But he takes the conversation away from that, away from what the left would say is the problem and the right would say is the problem. And he says, perhaps a biblical way of looking at this is to start with the self. So he continues, he says, theologians should concentrate less on social arrangements and more on fostering the kind of social agents capable of envisioning and creating just, truthful, and peaceful societies, and on shaping a cultural climate in which such agents will thrive. So that's just a little bit of an interesting twist. And I cannot help but think, Jesus coming into a political climate where you've got Rome being quite an obvious oppressor in that setting. You've got a religious elite being very corrupt within the Jewish authorities. But yet he comes into that space and he talks about repent, whether you are on the receiving end of this system or not. And he also says, take the log out of your own eye. How I see that as an Afrikaner is, we typically like to talk about the ANC and everything that is wrong in South Africa. But reading this, I think the invitation is to start with myself. And this is something that Wolf expands on quite a few occasions. So something else that stood out in this opening monologue of mine was he talks about Jürgen Moltmann, who was his promoter at a PhD level and sort of considered the father of the liberation theologies. I think there are smarter people here that can correct me. But he says, I like what Jürgen Moltmann says, and the cross is definitely the symbol that God identifies with the victim. But then he says, without wanting to disregard the theme of divine solidarity with victims, I will pick up and develop here the theme of divine self-donation for the enemies and their reception into the eternal communion of God. Now, that is quite radical.
Sorry, Helen, won't you repeat that last sentence? I missed some of the words that you said. Sorry.
Yeah. Without
so one, you talked about identifying with the victim, and then you said something about the enemies, and I just didn't hear it. Sorry.
So, without wanting to disregard the theme of divine solidarity with victims, so he is very much on board with that, I will pick up and develop here the theme of divine self-donation for the enemies and their reception into the eternal communion of God, which is quite radical in our current sort of call-out culture,
Johan, please just confirm it's self-donation, right? I think it's donation rather than damnation. I think it's coming out sounding like damnation.
Not damnation. Yeah,
donation. Yeah.
Donation. Yeah. No. Self-damnation, that's a different book. So it's interesting, just to me at least, where we've got this, where we're constantly vilifying the other or our so-called enemy, whether, I mean, the way that I approach this thing is from a racial perspective, but I know some of you guys are thinking in other categories. But instead of just vilifying that person, our problem is in our society today is that everybody considers themselves the victim one way or the other. And some of them are definitely more the victim than others. But the problem is we are stuck that everybody thinks of themselves as the victim. And if you are othering that person as this monstrous object, then it becomes a little bit difficult to reconcile with them. So he's just stressing that, yes, God is for the victim, but make sure, just know that he is definitely for the perpetrator as well. And then he talks about this attitude of reconciliation. And this is something that blew my mind a bit. He says that the will to give ourselves to others and welcome them, to readjust our identity. So this is now the so-called enemy. Let's say you are a victim or you think of yourself as a victim, irrespective. The will to give ourselves to others and welcome them, to readjust our identities, to make space for them, is prior to any judgment about others, except that of identifying them in their humanity. The will to embrace precedes any truth about others and their construction of their justice. This will is absolutely indiscriminate and strictly immutable. It transcends the moral mapping of the social world into good and evil. So what I think he says here is that before we can talk about whose cause is just, before we can talk about who is the victim here and who's the oppressor here, you must answer to yourself this question: do I want to embrace the other person? Because at the moment, it seems more like we want to punish the other people. And I think he says there is a place for judgment. And maybe he doesn't use the word punishment, but I think we can assume that. But if you do not want to embrace that other person, then you will never have any form of reconciliation. And he would go as far as saying, I think, that you won't even be able to talk about truth and justice if you do not have that intention to truly embrace that other person. So he goes on and he says, how should truth and justice be identified? Negatively, my argument is almost a Nietzschean one. There is far too much dishonesty in the single-minded search for truth, too much injustice in the uncompromising struggle for justice. And then he says, the Nietzschean feel of the negative argument is, however, but the flip side of my positive argument, which rests squarely on the wisdom of the cross. Within the social context, truth and justice are unavailable outside of the will to embrace the other, which sort of a mic drop moment. Because everybody is talking about truth and justice, and later on in the book, he is going to talk about how difficult it is for us to talk about truth and justice, working a lot with Alistair McIntyre's book, Who's Justice, Which Rationality, or Which Rationality, Who's Justice, something like that. And McIntyre and Wolf just says that it's very difficult. We've got different theories of justice. We've got different theories of rationality. So we think that when we say this is a justice issue, the other person agrees with, yeah, this is a justice issue. But we've got different models in our mind of what justice is. So he says, before we go there, just know that it is going to be very difficult for you to talk about justice in any meaningful way if you not truly want to embrace the other person. If you just want to shame that person, if you just want to put them down, then you are going to be contaminated, so to speak, which I think is a profound point. And then in the chapter Distance and Belonging, some of the strong themes, I'm almost done, and sorry for going on this long. in the theme Distance and Belonging, in the chapter Distance and Belonging, he starts to talk a little bit more about Abraham and using him as a model. And I really like this. I mean, I've heard this before, but I really like the flesh that he gives to it. He says, excuse me, the whole idea of Abraham having to leave his people and move, that sojourner identity in the Christian gives us proper distance from our own race and religion and sex and identity, to just give yourself a little bit, not a critical lens, but a bit more perspective on yourself. So he says, at the very core of Christian identity lies an all-encompassing change of loyalty from a given culture with its gods to the God of all cultures. So by moving, so to speak, within ourselves, we are now not primarily identified as Afrikaans or Pedi or black or white or male or female. This, I think, might be a contentious issue in modern day identity politics, and maybe I'm reading him wrong. But we have this ability to look at ourselves more more critically. At least that is what we are called to do as followers of Abraham. He uses these words, which I find profound. Paul deprived each culture of ultimacy in order to give them all legitimacy in the wider family of cultures. Paul deprived, he's talking about the Apostle Paul now, deprived each culture of ultimacy in order to give them all legitimacy in the wider family of culture, of cultures. Through faith, one must depart from one's culture because the ultimate allegiance is given to God and God's Messiah, who transcend every culture. Christian children of Abraham can depart from their culture without having to leave it. Departure is no longer a spatial category. It can take place within the cultural space one inhabits. So there he says that we shouldn't be ashamed of being black or white or Afrikaans or Croatian or male or female or whatever. We must still be that. Because he says that if we now get on this bandwagon and say, yeah, I'm not those things, I'm only a Christian, he says that, well, the problem now is you're only going to create a third race. So now you're the Christians. And in a world already struggling with different tribes and different races, to add another one is not a very good way of dealing with it. So he says that Christianity is very unique in as much as it moves you, but it also keeps you there. So it's that distance. But there's also a sense of belonging in that particular area where you find yourself. And then obviously he talks a lot about creating space for in yourself to accept the other person. We need to move, because if you want to embrace, it means that you need to get rid of baggage. I think so. What he says, you need to get rid of baggage so that the other person can come in. And then the last thing that stood out for me is that he says that we are a Catholic personality as Christians, meaning that we are at once connected to loads of Christians from different cultures across the world. And if we read the Word of God, he says that we must be careful when we read the Word of God, because he says we underestimate our ability to twist the one Word of God to serve our own communal ideologies and national strategies. So he says that it's, well, he doesn't say that, but I mean, you've got Christian Afrikaners and Christian, you're very committed Christians in the EFF, and they're all very passionate about Jesus, but they come to very different conclusions based on that. And that's because even though they read the one Word of God, we shouldn't fool ourselves in thinking that we are as rational and as noble as we often think. So that's something that we need to do. And his solution to that is to take hands with other Christians, and they can pull you out of your own little world that you are caught in, your national strategies and communal ideologies. And by taking and pulling you out, they're going to help give you a little bit of distance, but you're still going to belong. You're still going to have a place. You're still going to be rooted, but they're going to give you a little bit of distance. So those are the things that I wanted to say. The only reason, this is not how this book club is going to be, I promise, but because I wanted to do two chapters, and I didn't have a chance to properly give you your homework. That's why this was a bit of a monologue. So forgive me for that, but please butt in.
Thanks, Johan. You will tell me when to stop, or you will mute me, so I won't worry too much about time. I was fortunate enough to be able to read the first two chapters, but several, in fact, at the beginning of the year. So all I have at this point in time, because it was a borrowed copy, are notes. I might actually ask you to pick up on some quotes and maybe read them out, although I read it from the older copy. That solidarity with victims and atonement with oppressors is I think it's really a critical point, and also this idea, this insistence that truth and justice can't be separated from the will to embrace, I think is a very different approach to the core Christian idea that ultimate reality is personal. Right, and for many Christians, that's the standard thing. Ultimate reality is personal; it's relational. God is ultimately all about relationship. So, for Wolf to say what he said is just a different way of, I suppose, in many ways, expressing that same idea: truth, justice, embrace, relationship. The things which struck me from chapter two. Let me just pick a couple. So the idea that so he speaks first of all about what is at the center, and you might have kind of touched on this a little bit, but he says the new center is a decentered center, at the center of which lies self-giving love. So the new center of, I guess, identity of the self, is the idea of self-giving love, in other words, Jesus Christ himself. On page 71 of the version I read, for the category of a Christian, it is a centered set with focus not on maintaining boundaries, but on reaffirming the center. So while there is a very clear idea about a boundary between, I guess, what is Christian and what is not Christian, or a boundary between myself and yourself, what the greater concern is for Wolf and what it should be for the Christian is the continual going back to Christ, going back to Jesus Christ, and centering oneself on the self-giving love, not self-negating, but just self-giving love. And I think that shift is really, really essential. Around the same place, and I'll stop here. This is a direct quote. I think I've got most of it here. Jesus made the intolerant demand of repentance and the condescending offer of forgiveness. I'm not sure if the scare quotes are actually in the original. They probably are.
Yeah, that's quite profound. I think actually you're in the next chapter.
I thought it was, were you doing chapter one and two?
Yeah.
Oh, have I jumped to two?
No. I mean, I might be wrong, but
I think we're doing the preface in chapter one.
But
thanks. Sorry.
But the point they tell is that he reached that in the Trinity, that the will to embrace. So I didn't mention that, but it's impossible to read this book without a very, very strong Trinitarian idea. Which we will revisit time again. Anybody else? Thanks, Itai.
It's more, I'm just wanting to respond to the initial point. And again, I sort of feel that, well, I haven't read it, so I'm really responding to some of the notes that you shared. So this idea of concentrating on fostering the kind of social agents, to the, you know, the individual versus the system. And I suppose I'm wondering if it's a false binary. Isn't it always a both and? Because the institutions that we create, the collectives we create, are made up of individuals. And so for me, it's both what is my individual responsibility and my individual salvation and redemption. But it's, and that's why, I mean, I like the way that he said it, or that you were phrasing it, but it's fostering a, what kind of social agents do we want to be? And I missed the rest of the sentence, but this idea that we then create, or we shape whatever the macro powers are, or the macro structures. But there's something around, it goes back to this kind of this individualistic idea within the church or within Christianity, that it's all about me. And in a sense, it does start with me. At the end of the day, I stand alone before God. You know, in terms of one day when I face judgment. But there's something about, I guess the question for me is, does God desire to redeem systems? Does he desire to redeem something that's more than the individual? Because then what is my hope? What, you know, is it just about my own individual salvation? So yeah, anyway, so that was just a kind of an initial response to that, is wondering whether it's a false binary. I'm not sure about what I'm saying.
I just want to say that that's not necessarily what Wolf says. That's what Wolf said there. And it's what I underline. So I need to be open that this is what I saw because I like it. But he's a very careful writer, and a couple of times he says, no, this does not mean that this does not blame the victim language. This is not, because there are real victims. And he gets into that in the following chapters, where he says that we are not stating here that, you know what, all sin, he uses this later on, he says, all sin is not equal or not equal, but they equally sin. So I think that's just the point that he's trying to make. He said, no, there are genuinely oppressors, and there are people who are genuinely oppressed. But he's just saying, from a Christian perspective, you need to understand that God called both to repentance. And he makes a big thing about, if you hold on to that, then you are going to become the oppressor that is now oppressing you. Again, we're going ahead of ourselves, but he's, so I think some of the things that he says is definitely applicable on the macro level. So that's just a comment. What about some of these academics? I know that the likes of Anandi and Karusta, and I think Madeline, you guys are like PhD students or doctors yourselves, having read this book. So please tell us how we should understand it.
Ioana, I'll just share with you what my favorite part is. Excuse me. Okay. No, I don't say I'm understanding it, but what I would want to say is I love the way that he starts, and how he starts off with his paper or lecture that he's presenting, and then that his mentor asks him a very difficult question and says, but can you do this in your own country? Can you really embrace the people that are hurting your own countrymen? And I love the response that he says, no, and kind of giving away that he also struggles with this. Mm-hmm. But as a follower of Christ, I believe that I should be able to. So I just like the way that he starts me with the reader kind of understanding that he's not going to tell me this is how I should do it, but this is his understanding and his own struggle with this. And I just have a bit of an appreciation for that. So yeah, that's my only remark.
And which is what makes him interesting, is he's not just a theologian in his ivory tower reflecting on this. He's a guy who saw the evil of Chetnik militants and Serbs, etc. So it's very personal for him, which I think gives him a bit of struggle credentials. Yeah. Thanks.
My mind is not with understanding this better than anybody else,
But the practice, I love Itai's, the way he differentiates between self-giving and self-negating. I'm thinking of the discussions I have with particularly girls, saying, and some boys, I was a youth minister. And so the discussions we have that just because you're a Christian, you don't have to be a doormat. And to embrace, but not to self-negate, to love the embrace the perpetrator, but also, yeah, I think you get the idea. It's just that to do that in to go into practice is my concern, and the way we communicate it, I think that's my main concern at this stage.
Can I read a quotation there? This is the one thing that I kind of marked, where he writes about women. And then he says, many women tend to give so much of themselves that they're in danger of being left literally without a self. In response to such suspicions, one could argue that the problem does not lie in self-donation, but in that men, and I would like to actually just say some men here, conveniently exempt themselves from the demand of self-giving they place on women. Would not a word of reciprocal self-donation response could be, you know? So he's talking about, it's not that they, it's wrong that they're giving it, but they are being exploited and not being made with self donation as you know, as well.
Yeah, so the model is the Trinity, but and the Trinity giving and not trying to put any attention on themselves, but the whole Trinitarian perichoresis, that dance of God, breaks down as soon as one says, okay, yeah, I like that, keep giving. So just because there's abuse in the system does not make it the wrong system. It just says that there is abuse. The one thing that I would point out, though, is that in my conversations with, let's say, middle-class people on the left and on the right, black, white, they are all concerned about giving too much. They are all concerned, no, I'm not going to compromise on this. I'm not going to compromise because we've compromised enough, our people. And other than that, we've compromised enough. So now it's not just one is necessarily taking. It's like everybody is suspicious that the other person is not going to give. And if I'm going to give, this person is just going to grab. And that's maybe this suspicion that we constantly have of others is what makes it we can't dance in this country.
So does Wolf solve that for us in a further chapter?
You'll just have to stay tuned, Torsten.
maybe does, maybe doesn't, but this is not exclusion and dance, eh? It's just exclusion and embrace. So embrace is the starting point.
Thanks, Ty. Sort out these Germans for me. I do want to, I'm going to pick on one or two people just because I suspect you are an academic and I think you might have dealt with him before. If I'm wrong, then just say I'm wrong. But I would like to hear your insight. If
you're wrong, Johan.
Oh, man.
I'm very flattered, but I'm not an academic and I haven't actually engaged with Wolf before.
Okay, great. All right. But you have the academic look, so just take that.
I'm taking it. Thank you.
Toby.
So, Johan.
Oh, sorry, who's that? Vera, go for it.
I haven't formed this or these thoughts fully, but when you started, you were talking about what in my mind became the willing victim. And I'm just trying to me, the idea of the willing victim, you know, of Jesus being willing to be the victim. There's so many facets to that. On the one hand, there's that self-giving, that it's a voluntary thing. But if I think about the words, the willing victim, I also think about abuse and about the victim who is sort of psychologically primed to put themselves into that position of being the victim, which is not what Jesus did.
Mm.
And there's sort of a line that isn't very clear to me about the difference between the two, because I don't think that Jesus is calling women to be abused, for example, and be in that kind of abusive relationship. So I haven't read the book.
Yeah.
So I can't say if there's anything in there that speaks to that.
So Itai spoke about decentering the self. And that means that you've got a little bit of distance to see some of the things that that you maybe latch onto from an identity perspective. So maybe I get to see my Afrikaansness, or maybe I get to see my masculinity, and that distance being created by decentering myself, going on a journey like Abraham, following Jesus, that just gives me a little bit of a vantage point. It means that when I have to lay something down now, I can see it's not an ultimate thing. So I can lay down some of these things and not necessarily stand for them. And that gives me, and victim is maybe the wrong word, but it makes me more sacrificial because I can see them for what they are, not bad in and of themselves, but in its proper place. But that does not mean that if somebody now comes in and undermines something, so if they undermine those things, then I can still be in this conversation and I can probably give them up. But when it is undermining, when it is abuse, then I can identify that. So this creates enough distance to see that for what it is. But if it's something that is not that, then I can deal with that. So it's a little bit like in the Gospel of John, when you compare that passion narrative and you've got this guy slapping Jesus and he says, you've got no right to do that. There's also that element. You know, being willing to do these things, but also to see, to take that kind of stand. I'm not sure if this is answer. I'm sure it's not answering you, but it's. I think the thing that we got that we typically stand on, and what inhibits us to truly do reconciliation, are things that we stand on that's not going to necessarily take anything away from our humanity. And if we're honest with ourselves and we look at most of the scenarios, I'm not talking about gender-based violence or that. That is a horrible example. But if we think of global struggles that we have, a lot of the time it's just because our ego is involved in some of these things. And it's actually something that we can take a bit of a stance back from and negate, so to speak. But I don't know.
I don't know whether we're getting there later, but I'm curious about our definition of embrace.
Yeah, there's a whole chapter on it.
Okay.
Yeah, he's got a whole thing on the drama of embrace. So what it, and in that actually, Marlene, you've got a big thing about still calling the thing wrong. So he says that. As a matter of fact, he says embrace is not possible without judgment. I'm definitely paraphrasing here, but there must be an element of judgment to say this is wrong. But that almost precludes. It's a precondition for embrace. But we're definitely getting there. Anything else? Mpo, what are you hearing from Mpumalanga?
Yeah. No, what I'm hearing is, yeah, like almost counter-cultural, like it's dealing with the stuff. Is definitely the solutions are not in most of the things that we imbibe and hear every day, to find true reconciliation, like from, you know, crisis perspective. Yeah, it's gonna take us digging deeper and going into uncomfortable spaces and throwing away things that we've embraced and believed, you know, all our lives. So so I'm enjoying this.
There's one thing, let me just read this. He talks about how you're gonna, if you follow Abraham, you have to know that you're gonna be in a very uncomfortable space. He says, in today's cultural climate, Abraham's kind of departure, that departure from your own culture, he says, it's not, you still belong, you still have one foot in your culture, so that's fine, but you've got one foot out of it. He says, in today's cultural climate, Abraham's kind of departure might receive censure from two opposite, though in some important respects, unified fronts. On the one hand, it might be challenged as too goal-oriented, too linear, not radical enough. On the other, it might be dismissed as too detached, too aloof, in some sense, too radical. So he's just saying that, just know that if you take this foot outside of your culture and you move and you allow yourself to be at that vulnerable place of the cross, then you're gonna have people calling you patronizing on the left, left, I'm just using this binary for the sake of argument, and sellout on the right. But you have to be ready to do that. So yeah, I think that alludes a little bit to what you say. Toby, you look like something very wise is gonna come from you.
No, you lost me 52 minutes ago. Half of this is over my head. I needed to take a sabbatical to read the book. So I can't help but actually hear you just summarize some of the stuff and thinking, you know, just well beyond politics and race to even family stuff, you know, and this with Mpo, you know, the fact that, you know, we call to embrace, I think that's what God calls us to do, is so countercultural at literally every level I can't get away from this. You know, I can avoid politics, but then I still have to live with my wife or my extended family, or, you know, and so I do find it immensely challenging. And at the same time, again, with Mpo, I don't hear this anywhere else in the world. I don't hear anybody else that is willing to say, yes, we want justice, yes, we want truth, but ultimately what we want is embrace. If ever this is needed, you know, it feels like it's now. So it's not embrace at the expense of truth and justice, but if ever I pursue truth and justice, it's always with this bigger goal of embrace in mind. And to me, that's, you know, that tempers my pursuit of truth, and that tempers my pursuit of justice, because ultimately those things aren't ultimate. They steps en route to embrace. That to me is, I think of personal relationships around me, and you know, even at that level, this stretches me, and it almost makes me think, you know, we need something supernatural to get us there. I'm encouraged and excited again to delve back into the book.
Yeah, because in our current call-out culture, it's all about shaming this person. It's all about calling him or her out for what they're doing and distancing yourself. That's not me. Just know that that's not me. And, you know, in this sort of virtue signalist, that's not a word, but in this kind of world, we're doing that. Whereas we are called to see that other person, not to vilify him or her. And, you know, typically we want to punish other people. When we talk about truth and justice, it's all about punishing that person. No, he must see this. But man, oh man, it's a lot more difficult. But that word that you use, tempered, I think he is not giving up on truth and justice. saying it's just all relative, but I think it's going to be a whole lot more tempered if, when I disagree with my brother in Black Lives First and EFF or whatever, that I really want to be reconciled to this guy. I don't want to shame him. I don't want to punish him. I don't want to laugh at him. I really want to be reconciled. It's a profound, profound idea. Anything else?
Can I just say something? You read a sentence about deconstruction of justice, and the whole idea of, I have an idea what justice should look like, and you have an idea of what it should look like. And maybe the question should be not just my willingness to embrace, but my willingness to hear how you see or understand what justice or righteousness would be in this situation, and not to enter into a dialogue. And again, it comes back to the willingness of embracing, the willingness to listen, to not come and say, this is the truth, this is how I know this, but to really even be open to deconstruct your own understanding of what it looks like or should be.
That is a very important point, and he talks about it in this distance and belonging, but he talks about it more and more. But he says, yeah, we need to see ourselves and our own understanding of God's future with the eyes of Christians from other cultures, listen to voices of Christians from other cultures, so as to make sure that the voice of our culture has not drowned out the voice of Jesus Christ. And then he says, so that's his big line. When he talks about, I think under the idea of the Catholic personality, is that just think for a moment that the way that you've always understood that particular passage or the Bible or justice or truth, it is possible that it's probable that it's tainted by self-righteousness, self-preservation, whatever. But when I go over the line, like, as an Afrikaner again, I ask Mpo Itai, okay, what am I missing here? This is how I read it, but I'm not the first guy who read this, so help me out. It's a beautiful image. They must help us pull us out. And likewise, in that conversation, we pull each other in, and we have that critical distance that helps us to see things. So it's a big, big, big point.
And related to that, the theory of having one foot in your culture and one foot in the Christian faith, I think it's important to have that, but it's actually much more difficult than what it sounds, because often our own culture and our Christian belief have become so intertwined that we can't actually differentiate so well between the two. And it's exactly why we need somebody from a different culture to actually speak to us, so that we can together work out what is actually our culture, what is our belief.
Yeah, I'm not sure if this is 100% relevant, but let me just read this bit. The children of Abraham are not strangers, pure and simple. So that's just to say, we're not just these floating people. It says, the children of Abraham are not strangers, pure and simple. However, their strangeness results not primarily from the negative act of cutting all ties, but from the positive act of giving allegiance to God and God's promised future. So therefore, when we are ashamed of being who we are, and I'm not that, sort of missing the point, because it's a positive act, it's not a negative act. When stepping out of their culture, they do not float in some indeterminate space looking at the world from everywhere and anywhere. Rather, with one foot planted in their own culture and the other in God's future, internal difference, they have a vantage point from which to perceive and judge the self and the other, not simply on their own terms, but also in the light of God's new world. Again, I'm not sure if that's relevant, Vera, but I thought about that when you...
I just, so one of the things, I don't know whether I'm getting some of this, but maybe to Vera's point, isn't there a sense, so again, the way I'm understanding what he says is that when I become a Christian, and my identity in some ways transcends the identity markers that I have in secular terms, right? But I mean, in any Christian context, my culture persists. So for me, there's this distinction between identity and culture. So whatever church I'm a part of, or whatever Christian community, it has a culture. I don't think my culture is erased. What I love about the way that I'm understanding what he's saying is there's a sense where also my identity is not erased. I'm still white, middle-aged, mixed heritage, whatever, in whatever dimensions of my identity. But it's that point you were saying about my allegiance to God and his future. So it's less about, I would imagine, it's less about, so again, coming back to this thing of countercultural. So given who I am, given my identity, what does becoming a Christian mean for that identity? And what does it mean for the kind of, again, collective culture? That for me, culture is a group thing. It's not an individual thing. So what do redeemed cultures look like? What is countercultural as distinct from my identity just becomes completely, well, not completely, but that's part of the redemption process maybe. There's something about my identity, that my identity in Christ transcends. It's more important than my rights as a woman or my rights as or my obligations as a white person or whatever. All of that gets shifted by my relationship to Jesus, I would think. So,
yeah, I also don't know the answer to that question of what does that culture look like, this redeemed culture. And I think it is something that we can think about, but we must be very hesitant to think about that. Well, not to think about it, to describe it with a lot of certainty, because my idea of a redeemed culture looks different from Hitler's idea of a redeemed culture. So I must just be aware of the fact that that's also contaminated with a lot of prejudice and whatever, which I think is why he's more interested in talking about the agents with which will produce that kind of culture rather than trying to describe that culture. Guys, does anybody else have something pressing to say? Otherwise, we can close.
Can I just make a small comment? I'm just interested by the theme of boundaries in this discussion. So identity revolves around boundaries and the activation and deactivation of those boundaries. And the idea that I get is that we cannot permanently deactivate the boundary of our culture as that's part of our identity. But to keep up the boundary, to activate the boundary of, I'm mixing it up now, but you get the idea. And on the other hand, the idea of boundaries, embrace is to deactivate boundaries. But how far do you deactivate your boundaries? How many boundaries do you deactivate so that you don't become the willing victim in the context that Vera also referred to earlier? So I'm just curious about all the implications for boundary talk that this have.
Well, we're going to have a look and see if it comes out of the text itself. And please also be on the hunt in your reading for something that might illuminate that. And if we are unsuccessful, the 30th of September, you can ask him to answer that question. Guys, if the defense rests, then I'm going to close and just say that next week, the idea is that we look at the chapter exclusion, which is directly after this distance and belonging. It's quite a thick chapter and it can be rough reading. So see if you can get into it. If you can't manage a lot of it, then still tune in. And if you find it valuable to get these little sound bites, then you are super welcome. You are welcome to also invite other people that you think might benefit from this.